Okay, we're studying from the Gnostic version of the testimony of St. John, which is very different from the other three so-called Gospels that were included in the Bible. And we're finding the reason it's so different is because it pretty obviously was written by a Gnostic writer, and it approaches things totally differently than the Synoptic Gospels, which have their value, but they don't really get into the principles for transcending and living above all the turmoil of mortal existence. They talk about principles that might lead you to that point, but they never actually get to the point, because they're written for those who haven't yet gotten there. Well, the testimony of St. John is a text for those who have come to the awareness of Gnosis. That is, they've come to the awareness that if you can learn how, you don't have to be continually, what St. Paul calls, blown about by the winds of mortal existence. You don't have to have life throwing you around all the time. So it's written from that viewpoint. And, that accounts for a whole lot of differences. But we're on chapter 12, which is Jesus is, according to the myth, on his way to Jerusalem for what we know. And he seemed to know, if not all of his, those who were with him did, that it was for his approaching crucifixion and resurrection. And we're going to learn about how those apply to us, what they really mean in terms of our own renewal and transcendence, because that's where the myth has meaning. Not as a historical event, which in fact may or may not have happened, but as a living reality now in each one of us. And that's what we want to find out about. So our story today starts 6 days before Passover. So you see we've got just a week left, less than a week left, before we get into the whole real highlight of the book itself. Because crucifixion and resurrection, those are our ways of looking at transcendent, of dying to the mortal condition, that is, no longer having a hold on you, and rising to living beyond that condition. So, 6 days before Passover, Jesus arrived in Bethany to meet Lazarus, whom he had raised from among those who had died. Now, we just a chapter or two ago spent a whole chapter on this raising of Lazarus. And we saw how Lazarus, in fact, is a mythic figure, and so were Martha and Mary and Jesus. They all had implications in terms of archetypes that are within us. And archetypes are personifications we make of numinous forces that are within each individual, but are usually unconscious. But they're being brought out through these myths. Now, why would Jesus now return to Lazarus? What's the point? There's always a point. Things aren't put, even if we're writing a story about history as it actually happens, we have to be selective. We decide what to put into it, and we naturally put into it what has some point in terms of our message or what we want to get across. So why does he return to Lazarus? Well, it sets the topic for death and resurrection, because that's all we think about when we think of Lazarus. That's what the story of Lazarus is about. It's been about dying and resurrecting, meaning coming to life on a new plane, a higher plane of existence, above all this turmoil that usually characterizes mortal existence. That's what Lazarus represents for us. So Jesus, according to this story, is turning our thoughts toward transcendence again, because that's what the whole rest of the account is going to be about. How we can transcend, as he archetypally transcends. So Jesus is on his way to Jerusalem to enact this divine drama of death and resurrection for us, so that as we center in with the story that's told of his death and resurrection, we can see what our own potential for transcending our limitations is. They prepared a special meal to welcome him. This is maybe prefigured the Last Supper, which again, in the testimony of St. John, is told completely differently than in any of the others. It doesn't even mention most of what the others mention, and tells some totally different things that focus us on a different aspect of the meaning of it. And by saying that they set out a special meal for Jesus as he's on his way to Jerusalem, and that it's set out with Lazarus, the symbol of death and resurrection, we're perhaps just pointing our minds toward the Last Supper, which is going to be an important part of what we're going to study when we actually get there. Then Lazarus' other sister Mary, taking a whole pound of very expensive scented ointment, anointed Jesus' feet and wiped them with her hair. We referred to this earlier because it's very tightly connected to resurrection. The whole house was filled with the scent of the ointment. Judas of Iscariot, Simon's son, that one of Jesus' disciples who was going to betray him. Now, Judas has been mentioned before, but here he's being introduced anew as a key figure in the remainder of the story. He's not just an incidental. So he's being brought in through this particular thing. Now, the anointing that Mary's doing, we learned, ties directly to the principle of resurrection. That it's a kind of a key that that's what's being talked about. So Judas is being brought right in here to the middle of the transcendence story. We need to look at who Judas is. And what we find is that we have this duality of Jesus and Judas as archetypes of light and darkness brought down to the mortal plane. And just as Jesus is the representation of light brought down to this mortal plane where we can relate to it and we can see it in terms of ourselves, Judas is an archetypal figure also of darkness brought down to this mortal plane, which we also have to deal with. We also have to relate to, because we are, much as we, in our high estimation of ourselves, might sometimes like to think so, not just light. We're not just good. We're not just whole. In fact, we have very little of those things when we start out. We have to deal with darkness in order to become the light. And this is why Judas is not just an incidental to the story. Now, you hear people trying to explain Judas in human terms. And they want to say, well, Judas was really didn't have bad motives, or he really just wanted to prod Jesus into doing what he should do, or lots of different things. And you can read whole books of this, about this, movies about it. But the point is being totally missed. Judas is not just a person working things out. He's an archetypal figure, just like Jesus is. You know, Jesus is the archetypal figure of light, so we don't expect him to do negative things. Now, as a human being, if he was a human being, perhaps he could do negative things, but that's not the point. He's presented here as an archetypal figure. Judas is also an archetypal figure. And we never hear of him doing much of anything good, because he's an archetypal figure of the opposition. We have to look at them as those two things, otherwise the story just doesn't go anywhere. So both Jesus and Judas represent aspects of ourselves. We have within us the light, we have within us the darkness, and they work with each other and against each other in helping us grow into our potential, if that's what we're trying to do. We use them both. And that's why we have to recognize them both. We have to see how they can work together. It is true that without Judas, the story wouldn't have gone the way it did. It's a part of the story. That's not meant to say anything about him personally. It's because as an archetypal figure, he's beyond that. It's meant to say that he's a part of the reality and we have to deal with the wholeness of it. So Judas exclaimed, "What a waste! This ointment could have been sold for $30 and the money given to the poor." Actually, I'm still quoting from the record when I read this. Actually, Judas didn't care anything about the poor. But as treasurer of the band of disciples, he was embezzling funds from the common fund. So he had a personal interest in encouraging donations. "Leave her alone," replied Jesus, "for she has saved this ointment until now, so that she could anoint me to foreshadow my death and resurrection." So once again, the point is that it's death and resurrection that this is all about. It isn't about money. It's about focusing our minds toward what's going to happen. Then Jesus says something else in relation to it. "The poor will always be here for you to help, but I will not be here with you much longer." We call this the law of propriety. The law of propriety is that everything has a right time to do it and a wrong time when it should not be done. That an act is not in and of itself good or bad. That it all depends on the consequences, the timing, that we can decide whether a thing is good or bad. So we have to always be aware of timing. Because the thing that might be right to do right now might not be right to do a week from now, or a day from now, or even an hour from now. We have to be sensitive to this if we're going to do the right things. this is the overriding law of all laws, if you will, although we're not big on the concept of law, but we really mean our, when we say law, we mean like a major principle. Because any other principle I could bring out, you could probably come up with an example where it wouldn't hold. So, the law of propriety is what gives it a holding. It's what says that there is a time that is right and a time that is not right. Word of Jesus' presence spread and many people came to Bethany. They not only came to see Jesus, but also to see Lazarus, whom he had raised from among those who had died. In fact, the leaders of the priests were conspiring to have Lazarus killed, because many of the people believed in Jesus' power after seeing Lazarus and hearing his testimony. Because evil reproduces itself. Now, you may remember that from an earlier lesson that the high priest, Caiaphas, said, one person must die to save the people. Now, two people must die to save the people, Jesus and Lazarus. And that's how it escalates. So there is no little wrongness. I mean, it's true that some things are worse than other things, but it tends to escalate. So even in the little things, we try to discern what's the good thing to do. Because it grows if we don't. Now, on the other hand, if we discern the good things to do, they grow too. So the little decisions are a whole lot of what make up life. And we try to base them on what will increase good. And we know that's the good thing to do. There's no list of rules that can tell you what that is. That's the problem with the Orthodox approach. No list of rules works, because in one situation, one thing is good, in another is good. And I know that this is not a highly looked on idea in Orthodox minds, but it's still true, no matter what, you can't get around it. A rigid rule book always leads to unhappiness. But if we try, and even in the little decisions, to evaluate and make good decisions, this grows and escalates. And if we don't, it grows and escalates, and soon we're killing two people instead of one. Hoping that that isn't what it is, but that's what it was for these people. Then later on, they have to kill Stephen, the first, who's called the first Christian martyr after Christ, he was. It had grown further. They had to kill somebody else to try to stop it. Then they needed to kill Paul. They failed, but he was the next one they tried to kill, and there were many others, and on it goes. You get locked into a negative pattern when you start on a negative path. So you just got to cut it off and try to make good decisions from the beginning. So that's the problem with moral existence. The good news is that good also reproduces itself. And each act of goodness flows out to many blessings. So maybe one little good thing, but there's no telling how much good will come out of it in the long run. Most of us probably have stories of that. And that's more where we want to be focused. Well, the next day, as Jesus approached the city of Jerusalem, a large crowd assembled, welcoming him as a ruler. Now, the city of Jerusalem is the place in this book where Jesus is always shown as encountering mortal mind and conflicting with it. In other words, the archetype of holiness conflicts with mortal mind, and Jerusalem is the place that's presented as that happening. As he approaches Jerusalem this time, there's a big crowd welcoming him as a ruler. Now, what's the word ruler in Greek? Archon. They're seeing him as someone who can step in and take over and save them. Sound familiar? Go to any Baptist church. I don't mean to pick on the Baptist, but any of them, any Orthodox church. I pick on them because that's the one my family went to. But they'll say, you know, accept Jesus Christ as your Savior. Now, those are not bad words. But what they mean is, let him take over your life. Let him be your archon, your ruler. And that's what was happening here. There's a warp on the reality. Now, Jesus continually said, according to the stories, that he didn't come to be that kind of a ruler. But that's how the people were seeing him. Jesus sent two of his disciples to procure a young donkey. When they returned, Jesus mounted the donkey and rode it into the city. Now, it appears that he was using symbols here to announce that he was the promised Messiah who could lift the people above the misery of mortal existence, but not as an archon, but as a path as showing them how they could learn to make the decisions that would lift them above mortal, the misery of mortal existence. John points out that this event was just as the prophet had foretold. He says, "Do not." When the prophet said, "Do not be afraid, daughter of Zion, for your ruler is coming riding on a young donkey." In other words, Jesus was deliberately fitting into a prophecy there to try to lift their vision out of this place where they wanted him to just take over their lives. He wanted them to see him as a divine way shower, fulfilling statements that their prophets had said, instead of as someone who would just save them if they'd say words or do the thing or whatever it was. That's not the kind of way he came to show. And he was trying, so he's trying to lift them above this, since they were trying to declare him their archon, the one who would take over. At the time, his disciples did not understand what he was doing. But after he had ascended in divine light, they realized that the things which he had done, which had been done to him, had all been foretold by the prophets. That is, that he was an archetypal figure, fulfilling what the prophets had said about archetypal figures. So he's telling us plainly that while Jesus was alive, his disciples didn't really realize this was what was going on. They still weren't getting the vision of it. But later, it worked in them. They began to see that they weren't just dealing with some little daily events, and they weren't dealing with someone to take over their lives. They were dealing with something that went beyond just historical events. That's really kind of how it is with archetypal revelations. Because the unconscious speaks another language from what we do. It doesn't speak in words. So its meaning is not immediately clear. It projects images to us, like when we sleep in our dreams, or when we're daydreaming, or thought images that just jump up into the consciousness sometimes. But what they mean is not very clear. Read the Revelation of St. John the Beloved. The images are graphic, but what they mean is beyond anybody's figuring out, which is why we get all these, you know, at the transition to 2000 again, we had all these people thinking they knew what it meant, and the world was coming to an end. But it doesn't have anything to do with the world coming to an end. It has to do with images coming out of the unconscious to help lead to transcendence. And until we can get a glimmer of the language, we don't know what's being talked about. And that's what happened with the Jesus disciples. It took them time to be able to understand the meaning of the things he did and what he had to say. Eventually, we can learn to understand the language, and then the message comes through. Well, some Greeks who have come up for Passover want to see Jesus. They approach Philip, who was known as one of the Gnostic disciples. The Principles of the New Covenant, one of our Gnostic texts, is sometimes attributed to Philip. Philip goes to Andrew, who's another one who was known as being a Gnostic disciple, author of the Mystery of the Resurrection, another text. And then together they approach Jesus. So, in the manner we've become used to in the testimony of St. John, this becomes an opportunity for Jesus to unfold some principles. What keeps happening is we have a little story, and then Jesus goes on and on in the story. Now, then, there's no likelihood that anybody actually did it this way. Probably would have lost the audience right near the beginning anyway. But that's the pattern that the book uses to introduce these different concepts and talk about them. So, this time Jesus is reported to have said, "The time has come for the Son of Man's light to be manifested." Now, Son of Man is an archetypal title anyway. Man, in Greek, anthropos, was one of the terms Gnostics used for God. Still is. That the divine is what we are brought to its fullness. And, well, you can look at it the other way. The divine is the potential of what we can become if we develop to our fullness. Either way, the divine was called anthropos, or divine anthropos. And therefore, or man, not meaning male, but just meaning human. And therefore, the projection of that to mortality was called the Son of Man, meaning the Son of divine anthropos. And so it's an archetypal figure always. Sometimes Jesus applied it to himself, not very often, but occasionally, just as he does right here. When he does, he's putting himself into an archetypal role. He says, "The time has come for the Son of Man's light to be manifested." These Greeks have come looking for Jesus. He's saying, "Okay, it's too late for me to just be in a little backwater corner of Judea anymore. My light is going to be shining out to Greeks and others, all kinds of people." He said this because they weren't Jews. And the Jews generally thought, although they weren't as close then as they were sometimes, that the teachings were just for them. He said, my teachings are for all mankind. These were probably converts to the Jewish faith because they weren't Jewish in the Passover, but they weren't Jews. Jesus is saying, the Son of Man archetype isn't for Jews, it's for everybody. And that's going to get manifested now. So he's indicating this is the beginning of taking Gnosis for all mankind. And although some of his disciples didn't get the point for quite some time, even after his ascension for a while, but he is pointing it out so that eventually they would realize what he's saying. Okay, verse 24. Jesus goes on, he says, you know that unless a grain of wheat is buried in the ground and dies, it will not be multiplied. Only if it dies can it produce a new stalk of wheat with many grains on it. A person who loves the illusion of mortal life will lose that life which is real. But a person who sees mortal life for the illusion it is will cause it to be transformed into life eternal. Everyone who wants to serve me should follow the path I follow. Perfect explanation of him as an archetype. He's laying out a path for us to follow. Those who become my disciples will go where I'm going, for my father and mother will honor those who choose to follow me. So he's making it very clear that the path he's following to the cross and beyond, because Gnostics don't really focus on the cross except as a transition point, it's the beyond that's the real important thing. But that this is an archetypal path that each of us is going to follow as we send to the parents. We're all going to the cross, and we're all going beyond the cross, just as Jesus did, if we're ascending to the parents. Following the way that he's laying out. I'm troubled by what is going to happen to me. But what can I say? I could say, Father, Mother, don't make me go through this. But this is part of the reason I descended to this world of darkness at this time. My desire is to demonstrate the radiant light of my parents' name through what I do. This is basically the equivalent of, in John, of the account of the Garden of Gethsemane that we find in the Gnostic text. His saying, this isn't really what I want to do, but this is the only way I can reach the ego with the meaning of transformation, the power of transformation, which we call the power of the cross sometimes, because the cross is the means of transformation. You look at old icons, you'll see Jesus walking across, walking across a cross. He's walking on a cross as a bridge to get across to those who have gone on, to those who have died, and so forth. The cross is a means of moving on. For us, it's a means of moving on to a life that is above the cross. There's a Gnostic myth of one of the disciples went into a cave, overcome with sorrow because Jesus was being crucified, and he saw a vision of the crucifixion, and he saw someone hanging on the cross, and then he saw someone above the cross laughing. And it was explained to him that the death on the cross was something happening for those who were around the cross, whose minds were still centered in the mortal condition. But the reality was beyond the cross. The cross, the dying, that didn't have any reality. It was just the means of getting past it to the point of life, of real life. And so that's kind of what we're looking at here. Then a voice from the heavenly realm, meaning from the unconscious, said, the radiant light of our name has been demonstrated and it will continue to be demonstrated. Meaning through the life and ministry of the archetype of Christ, the divine light is being shown. And as we center in that, then it becomes clear to us now, our own potential, and it becomes clear to us. The people surrounding Jesus heard the voice, but they didn't understand it. Some said it was thunder that they heard, but others said that an angel had spoken to them. This is an indication that it is the voice of the unconscious, because often it's spoken of as thunder. You find that in the Revelation of St. John. That is, the unconscious doesn't speak with human words, so it sounds like noise until you get a feeling for the language. Not that your conscious mind ever clearly hears it the way we hear conscious language, but you can get the message as you work with it. And so some were beginning to get the point to hear the message. At least they thought it was an angel speaking. Others, they're just hearing noise. And by an angel, we mean an intermediary between the hyperconscious, that part of the unconscious that's divine, and the ego. So they were seeing it as a means of the divine speaking. This this voice did not speak for my sake, Jesus told them. It spoke for your sakes. Now, this is a frequent theme in John. It's like at Lazarus' tomb, when Jesus said in his prayer to the parents, I'm just saying this for the sake of those who are here with me, so that they will realize that it is you who sent me to the mortal plane. He's stating clearly his awareness that his life is archetypal. He's speaking his prayers, and not because he felt he needed to say them, but because he knew people needed to hear them. He was acting as an archetype. What he's saying, this voice that they're hearing coming out of the unconscious, it's not for him. It's an archetypal voice for those who need to hear it. He's acting for our benefit, for our enlightenment. He goes on to say the archons are psychic forces that work to hold us down in the mortal awareness so we don't rise above it. The archons which rule this world will contribute to their own destruction through the events which are about to transpire. That is, it's the archons that are bringing about the crucifixion and the attempt to destroy him, and in the very process, that's what destroys their power, because he shows us how to transcend beyond the archons' power. It is a time of crisis when the power will be generated through which the dark source of mortal illusions will develop. Once more, he's saying it's a critical time in the psychological development of mankind. It was a time of a great leap forward. It's not the only one there's been, but it was a major one in consciousness for all of mankind, where people began to perceive themselves as individuals rather than just part of a big collective. And this, even though a whole lot of horrendous things happened in the name of Christianity after, still the heightened awareness that was there especially through the Gnostic teachings of Jesus, had an effect that didn't get completely lost, whatever periods of darkness have come in the meantime. The archons are trying to keep mankind locked in ignorance of mortal mind, but their very efforts generate the power to lift us to a higher level of consciousness. When I am lifted up from the ground, Jesus continued, I will lift up everyone who is willing to come with me. Now, he's intimating he's going to be killed by crucifixion, that's being lifted up from the ground. But the important thing is that he says the objective is for us to go through that crucifixion with him. Not so that we'll be hanging on the cross, but so we'll go beyond the cross with him. We too need to die to ego-centeredness so that we can be resurrected as divine consciousness. That's basically what he's telling us. Those who were listening replied, why do you say that the Son of Man must be lifted up, when Moses says that the Christ will remain forever? What do you mean when you say the Son of Man? Good question. We touched on it already. They seem to have some understanding that the term Son of Man is archetypal, or they wouldn't have asked the question. But Jesus is applying the term to himself, and they're finding that confusing. What they're not saying is that he is living out an archetypal role for them, so that their minds can receive that role better, because it's harder for them to see it in just abstract terms. Harder for any of us to work with the abstract and the concrete, although we try to go into that. Jesus replied, the light is going to be with you a little longer. Make all the progress you can while it is light. For when darkness comes, you can no longer tell where you're going. Embrace the light while it is here with you so that you can become children of light. So he didn't try to directly counter their confusion. Apparently carried them as far as the people who are asking where to go. But he says it's a part of the process of coming to enlightenment, to let this work in you. Here, the Master has said something doesn't make sense. That's what that means. Here's something you can work with. But working until it starts to make sense, then you're going to start to be enlightened by it. Don't reject it because it doesn't make sense. Realize it's a tool. Doesn't mean you have to believe it either. Just means you let it work in you. What is the point? Keep asking yourself, what is the point, until suddenly the point is clear. Then you come further to enlightenment. And he's saying, don't put it off. Find enlightenment now while as far as working in it. Because if you put it off, it dwindles, eventually it dies, you lose your desire for transformation. So he says, now is the time. Now that is the point that's made off. And of course, what other time is there? Wait 50 years, it'll still be now, right? So it might as well be this now. This is the time that we can let it work. After he had said these things, Jesus went into seclusion. Despite the miracles they had witnessed, most of the people still did not believe in his power. Among the leaders of the people, however, there were many who believed in Jesus, but they did not admit it openly, knowing that if they did, the Pharisees would excommunicate them from their synagogue. They were more concerned about what mortals would say about them than they were about what the Elohim would say about them. So they hid what they believed. And of course, we can identify with that. It isn't always easy to be upfront if you are believing or representing something unusual, because people tend to come down. But on the other hand, you can't do much good that way either. Jesus went into seclusion to prepare himself for the significant and difficult events that were before him. When he came out of seclusion, he cried out to the people, "Whoever believes in me also believes in those who sent me. It is impossible to believe in me without believing in them. Whoever truly sees me sees also those who sent me." So he's declaring himself as the connecting principle that leads us to the hyperconscious, the divine in us, that of the parents within us. He's saying, if you can get as far as me, you're going to get the whole way. And accepting that, accepting him as the reality is really the hard part. Now, you can accept him as your savior, but it doesn't necessarily mean anything. To accept him as a transforming principle in you that can lead you to where you become divine so that you can be with the divine, that's not the easy part. But once you can see the reality of that and understand the means, then the rest of it is, as they say, a piece of cake. "I have descended to the mortal plane as a light, so that those who believe in me do not have to remain in darkness." So we can see the way to our transformation. "I am not condemning those who do not believe my teachings when they hear them, for I did not come to condemn anyone, but to save everyone who can be saved. Those who reject me, refusing to accept my teachings, cannot escape being evaluated by truth at the end of time. That truth which I descended to the mortal plane to reveal, for I have not made up my teachings." By truth, we don't mean something abstract, we mean the reality, what it really is. We all have to measure up against that, because that's either we go into it, or we're outside of reality, one or the other. "I have taught that which I was taught by my father and mother who sent me. I have faithfully repeated what the father and mother told me, because I know the principles they teach lead to life everlasting." This is Jesus' testimony of the source and validity of his teaching. And he is unfolding those principles of transformation that elevate the soul to divine life. And that's really the key to the whole thing. That's what the whole thing is about. What the reason whoever wrote this book wrote was, he wanted us to know that there was the body of teaching here that were being put in Jesus' mouth. I guess I could say Jesus' archetypal mouth, because it's unlikely that he ever delivered all these long lectures the way they are. They're probably a compilation of many things that were said brought together. But the author is saying, these teachings have power to show us how to change and be transformed so that we become so much more than what we were before. And at the end, he's put this testimony in Jesus' own mouth, that's exactly what it will do. Many of us who let it work in us flow into that testimony, that it changes us. It doesn't make us flawless, it doesn't make us all we wish we were sometimes, but it makes us so much more than what we ever were before. That's the testimony, the valid testimony, the testimony that makes it worth learning, because it helps us all transcend more than we were. Amen.